So we'll start with the lecture verse. Go up there just a second, my pages are coming off here. Okay. We'll just do that. The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember it and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So thank you all for braving the ice. I guess at least we have ice on our property, but and making it out here. So if you have not been at Shasta Abbey before at this time of the year, we obviously do some holiday decorations. Okay, and you might wonder about that. So we've got trees on the altar. We kind of consider them jewel trees, or some Buddhists consider the trees, the Christmas tree is rather the tree that the Buddha sat in front of when he was enlightened. And we've got wreaths and garlands. And yeah. So it's, you know, we've been doing this for many years. Recently had our fall training term ending retreat. So this is the monks. So we have a 7-day retreat, and that ends with us sitting till late at night, and then we get the opportunity to ask a spiritual question of our Master Mayan, our abbess. She, of course, gives a helpful reply. But this retreat at this time of year in Zen Buddhism and some Pure Land schools of Buddhism is called the Rohatsu retreat. And Rohatsu literally means the 8th day of the 12th month. But what it's referring to is the Buddha's enlightenment. Okay, so that's why that last day of the retreat we sit till late in the evening, sort of slightly into the next day. Things go on with our ceremony, and we're celebrating, honoring the Buddha's enlightenment. Nowadays, some people call this Bodhi Day, so, and I think that's on the 8th of December. And interestingly, you find in Buddhism that we don't all celebrate the same thing on the same date, because in fact, a lot of Buddhists celebrate the Buddha's birth, life, enlightenment, and parinirvana, his death, at Vaisak, which is in April or May. And it's in different dates in April and May, depending where you are in the world. And I think it's great, because you've got, you know, things. We're honoring the Buddha throughout the year. Okay. Put this here, because this paper wants to fall on the ground. So, when it comes to December, as you all probably know, and probably even better than me, much better than me, that different world religions celebrate different things in December. November, December, maybe into January a little bit. You've got, in Hinduism, the Sikh religion, Jainism, they practice Diwali. It's a Festival of Lights, which I think it happens at the end of October into November, where the lights light up the way for the goddess of fortune to come to people. You've got in Judaism, you've got the celebration of Hanukkah this month, which I gather, and I hope I'm correct on this, is also a celebration of light, partly. Kwanzaa, which is maybe a newer holiday, but it's a celebration of African-American culture. And then also in December, from time immemorial, you've had the celebration of the solstice at this time of year. Often when you see that, they talk about the solstice, they say the pagans celebrated that. Honestly, I'm not quite sure what the pagans were, other than they weren't us. You know, I mean, I'm sure their religion was very valid. Okay. So, and it's interesting that a number of these celebrations have light as a symbol. Okay. So this is the darker time of year. It makes sense, light, you know, to light up the darkness. And of course, that can extend into our own life, to light up the darkness of our own life. So my teacher, Reverend Master Jiyu, enjoyed decorating and festivating in December. Not everybody did, but she did. And she actually did it from a very kind place. She knew that we were living in a monastery, away from our families, away from the things we were used to, and it was winter, and you know, winter can be cold and snowy here, and there's a lot of darkness in terms of light and day, you know. So she liked to celebrate, and I think also she didn't have the best childhood in terms of celebrating. It was during World War II, part of her childhood. That was not a great time in England. You were being bombed. And also her family life was maybe not the happiest. But anyway, she enjoyed celebrating. And she herself didn't have a lot of money, but she would take the little bit of money that she had sometimes and buy us treats and gifts. You know, in those days, there was no internet. It was the schlock catalogs. And, you know, she'd come up with these, you know, really nice small presents. But you know, with presents, it's not the present. It's what's behind the present. It's the intention. It's the kindness, the generosity. And she called Christmas Buddhamas. Because, you know, Buddhists kind of struggled with, well, what do we call this, you know, this time of year? Okay. So I wanted to read to you from a story of another... Bring that with me. Oh yeah, it's here. Another Buddhist teacher who has a lot of parallels with Reverend Master Jiyu. He's Ajahn Chah, the very famous Theravadan forest teacher in Thailand. It's just a little piece from this booklet called No Ajahn Chah. It was Christmas and the foreign monks had decided to celebrate it. They invited some lay people as well as Ajahn Chah to join them. The lay people were generally upset and skeptical. Why, they asked, were Buddhists celebrating Christmas? Ajahn Chah then gave a talk on religion in which he said, as far as I understand, Christianity teaches people to do good and avoid evil, just as Buddhism does. So what is the problem? However, if people are upset by the idea of celebrating Christmas, that can be easily remedied. We won't call it Christmas, let's call it Christ Buddhamas. Anything that inspires you to see what is true and do what is good is proper practice. You can call it any name you like. So it's interesting, they both called it Buddhamas. So personally, you know, I have no problem calling it Christmas. Christ was a good person. He had good teachings. It's just, are we following them? And yeah, wishing people well, wishing people a Merry Christmas doesn't upset me, like being a Buddhist. Okay. So as a child, I noticed people were a little kinder and more friendly with one another this time of year. You know, people would wish each other Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. You can just see it on people's faces. The stress and tension had relaxed a bit. Now, unfortunately, Christmas has become more and more commercialized. We have Cyber What Monday, Black Friday. I don't, you know, it's just endless opportunities to buy more and more. And it's not the point of Christmas. I mean, the exchanging of gifts is very nice, but it's really the intention and the mindset behind there that matters. And the smallest gift, when given with a good heart, kind heart, is just as good as an expensive gift. I personally like some of the Christmas carols. You know, it used to be right after Thanksgiving. They started on the radio. They ran to Christmas. Now it's the night before. You get a few of these stations that play Christmas music all the time. And, you know, some of them are okay, but some are a little strange, the Christmas tune. But some of them are really nice. I was raised in a family of seven kids. So we had this practice of giving each other presents the night before Christmas, and then Christmas Day, Santa Claus would come, and there would be the presents for everybody. And, you know, we used to get each other, the kids used to get each other presents. We'd go to the five and dime stores of those days, the equivalent of small Walmart or whatever, you know, tiny little stores that sold cheap things, and we'd give each other cheap things. My oldest sister was a real sweetheart. She used to work during the Christmas holiday at department stores because they needed extra help. And then she'd get paid, and then she'd take all that money and buy us stuff, and buy the kids stuff. Sometimes it would be, you know, a piece of clothing my parents couldn't quite afford, because seven kids. Even in those days, money only went so far. And we were not deprived of anything. We had the best medical care, education, food. You know, we had clothes on our back, warm clothes on our back. But we couldn't have the fancy sweaters. And when I went to high school, people would have their shirts sent to laundries and have the collars starched. I couldn't afford that. You know, they were button-down shirts, but you button down shirts, but you didn't button them down. You starch them, and you had fancy sweaters and all these shoes, and you know, I mean, we bought our clothes either hand-me-downs or from the basement of Penny's, some department store. And it was fine. The strange thing that happened at the school too is some of the kids, because they felt the real pressure of the, you know, keeping up with the clothing, is that they steal from the department stores. They go in with a loose-fitting pair of pants and try on a bunch of pair of pants under there and walk out. And, that, you know, I thought that wasn't such a good idea. You know, and believe me, I was no saint. I did many other things that weren't so good. But I just thought, you know, what does it matter? And fortunately, I went to school right by Haight-Ashbury, graduating from high school in 1968, and the world changed. You know, clothes were not important anymore. You wore old work boots and T-shirts, and you know, you got your clothes at Salvation Army. It was great. Okay. Yeah, this is an interesting thing that I heard about years ago. So there was a Christmas truce in World War I. It just lasted a couple days. Okay, and it happened in 1914. World War One was largely trench warfare, so you had your trenches where you were fighting each other, and in between it was what they called no man's land, because that's the way you advanced if you wanted to advance, but a lot of times you lost your life. World War One, also machine gun was invented during that time, and the horrid, you know, gases that they would gas each other with. But anyway, on Christmas Eve in 1914, you had the British soldiers in one set of trenches, the German soldiers on the other set of trenches. And the British soldiers late at night on Christmas Eve could hear singing coming from the British soldiers, because they weren't that far away from each other. And they heard them singing Christmas songs and patriotic songs. And so then they started shouting back and forth, the trenches, the British and the English, they start shouting back and forth. Before you know it, they're up out of the trenches. Okay, actually, this is on Christmas Day. They're up out of the trenches, and they met in this no man's land, and they exchanged gifts, exchanged cigarettes, took pictures of each other, And some of them played soccer against each other. But it was a truce. There was no, you know. And this just happened on a very small part of the what you call the Western Front. It wasn't the whole Western Front. But it lasted that day and a half. Now, unfortunately, those in charge, at least some of them, saw this and thought, oh, this is no good. You know, if they you know, get together too much and have a party and all, they're going to realize that they're just all human beings and, you know, grow more and more sympathetic to each other. So consequently, they got them back in the trenches and they started up the war again. Terrible. But you can see the power of something like that, you know, where they were used to celebrating Christmas in their cultures. And that stopped the war for a day and a half. And that was something. Okay. So as a kid, I also wondered why it was that the real spirit of Christmas, the generosity, the kindness, the friendliness with each other, the compassion. Why didn't we celebrate that all year long? Why was it just for a certain time of year? It seemed, you know, be a good idea if we kind of expanded it a bit. And of course, you know, some people do. So I'm going to kind of end this with another story I want to tell you, which was kind of the main thing of my talk here. And this is a story that I heard at a monastic gathering. So different Western monks, we used to meet years ago. I think some of them still do, but we used to meet years ago from the different traditions. And someone told this story. So it's been quite a number of years. I'm probably going to be embellishing. I can't say that I got all the facts straight, but I know the basic story. It's quite a beautiful story in terms of Buddhist teaching. So I call it the Buddhist Christmas story. And not in any way in talking about this person, because I didn't know who they are. And I can only presume that they're the ones, this person is who is in this story, is the one that told others about it, because he was the only one there. Okay. So it's a Western monk is in Thailand somewhere, and he's a real meditator, and he hears about this place because he sought out really ideal places to meditate, and he heard about this place where they'll take you from the little village in a boat and put you on this, I think it was an island in the middle of this, it must have been a lake or something. And they leave you there overnight. They come back, so you're there. But it was a really great place to meditate. Okay. And so, of course, he was really enthused about this, and he had the opportunity to do it. So he gets out there, you know, he gets off the boat, and he gets out there. I don't know if there was a cave on the island or whatever, but it was apparently a really great place to meditate. And he sits down to meditate. Okay, and it's evening time now, and he can hear from the as he sits down to meditate, he hears from the shoreline in this terrible recording with this terrible loudspeaker, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Okay, so he hears it over this loudspeaker. Now, what also happens is it just repeats over and over. It doesn't stop. You know, it's not a long. I'm going to read part of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer for any of you who are not familiar with it. So it just kept going. So he became frustrated, angry, upset, whatever. And this went on for hours because it didn't go away. And it was a terrible recording. And it was this Christmas song that some people would find very obnoxious. Okay, so let me read Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer for you here. So, and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer came on the scene in 1949. And it was Gene Autry who was the person who was sang it, and let me get rid of these pages here. I think I dealt with them. Gene Autry, who sang it, and it became a big hit. In fact, it's the second best-selling Christmas song of all time. How about that? Okay. So here we go. You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen, but do you recall the most famous reindeer of all? Rudolph the reindeer, I'm not going to sing it, had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, it's very lyrical, this, Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight? Then how the reindeer loved him as they shouted out in glee, Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer, you'll go down in history. And then it just repeats. Okay. So this is going, you know, this is going on this loudspeaker, and as I said, he can't get away from it. I don't think it would have been proper to plug up his ears, you know, for meditation. It's just not something you do. So it just kept going on. After a while, it breaks him down, and he begins to listen to the story, listen to the words of the story. And he gains great sympathy for Rudolph. Yeah, because, you know, I mean, he's got the name Rudolph, and all these other people are Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen. And, you know, they won't let him join in the reindeer games. He's an outcast. But finally, you know, there comes the opportunity where his glowing nose is an attribute. And, of course, Santa Claus realizes this, and he leads the sleigh. So completely turns it around for the other reindeer. So at least I think what I heard is this monk started crying when he really listened to what the story was. And you know, sympathy is actually in Buddhism one of the signs of enlightenment. When we really listen or see what's happening, it's a sign of enlightenment. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a interesting little song. But he got something out of it, okay? And so, you know, he begins to relax and not be all uptight and worried and, you know, and the like. And then what happens in a little while, I don't know what, maybe it was, you know, early hours of the morning or something now, with the dawning light, all of a sudden it stops. No more recording. I mean, this thing broke or somebody decided not to play it anymore. I don't, who knows what. But it stopped, and so he was able to just meditate in the quiet, okay? Which I'm sure he was grateful for. But he learned something, you know? So isn't it true of all of us, if we're seeking the perfect place or the perfect something or the perfect person or the perfect job, or we're just setting ourselves up. It's not going to happen. It's not that, with terms of meditation, it's not that it isn't good to have a quiet place to meditate. It's really good, you know. But you can't control everything around you. One summer here, this is the only hall we had in the beginning. Okay, this was both the ceremony hall and the meditation hall. Well, they were working on the freeway. And I think we're getting up at 4:30 in the morning or something. But they were out there working really early. So you had jackhammers and stuff. But we had tons in here, and the tons started to rise up and down a bit with the heavy work they were doing on the freeway, because it's not far away. You know, there was vibration. You can meditate, okay? But perfect conditions. When I first started practicing in earnest, I was living in a Catholic community in Portland, and it was a house with about, I don't know, 16 of us living in it. So there was no privacy, you know. We all doubled up. And I tried to find a place to meditate. So I found this room in the basement where nobody went. It was really, you know, it was a dank place. cement walls, but it was quiet. It was great. And then we busted the sewer lines in the reconstruction we were doing. So I stuffed it full of rags, and I kept using it as a meditation place. It wasn't really smart, but it was this quiet place, you know, this refuge that I had. So quiet's good, you know. But what happens if you're doing your meditation at home, and you have your place where you do it, and you have a child, and the child starts crying? Well, can you just say, well, no, it's my time to meditate? It doesn't work that way. I mean, that's not proper meditation. And really, the point of meditation is that we take it off the cushion into our everyday life. Okay, it's great to have great meditation, but if you're not applying that to your everyday life, you're missing something. Okay, some people don't feel they're really good meditators, but boy, they apply the heck out of it to their everyday life. So I got to believe they're good meditators. Wenang, the famous Chinese ancestor, said about meditation, if you're wanting for your mind to be completely quiet, you know, nothing going on, he said you'd be dead. That's not thoughts come and go. It's the nature of the mind to think. And yes, we learn in meditation to quiet the mind, or sit below it is maybe even a better way to put it. And you know, things just come and go. Okay. And you know, the Buddha used to say that we have to meditate sitting, standing, walking, lying. So obviously it's for everything we do. That's the whole point of meditation, that we bring it out into our lives. And I think that in Buddhism, we can say that compassion and kindness, that trumps purity or holiness. You know, like the perfect meditation, or I'm the perfect meditator, or the most, you know, holy person. That's not really what Buddhism is about. It's about charity, tenderness, benevolence, sympathy. Okay? Those teachings come from the Buddha. And to be sympathetic, we need to learn how to listen. Okay? So that's what this monk did. He just listened, you know, and when he listened, it turned the whole thing around. So that's my Buddhist Christmas story, and thank you very much. I do these infrequently, so I forget that this paper, it wants to slide off the... I'll have to remember that for next time. All this stuff. And I hope that you have a good holiday season. Oh, and I was going to say, which probably will be announced at the end here, is that next week we are celebrating the Buddha's enlightenment. It's the 22nd? Yeah, because we celebrate it also at a time when we're not in retreat, and you all can come if you like. Yeah. And you know, some of us are a bit bah humbug about the holidays. There's some good things there, you know. I don't think bah humbug really helps you with suffering. It just makes more suffering, so why be bah humbug? You know, we don't have to get all, you know, out of proportion with the holidays, but you know, we can. It's a time to appreciate people, and to be kind and compassionate and generous. I got something in the mail the other day from an Indian reservation where they needed firewood. And I deal with firewood all the time. I wish I could just bring them trucks of firewood, but I can't. So I could give them a little bit of money for the firewood, because you know, it's cold where they are. But it's a time to be. And I don't have much money, so it's not a big deal. You know, what I give to any charity, but it's a time to be generous, you know, and see all that we have in our lives as opposed to what we don't have, because we have a lot. And you know, the world's kind of in a crazy place now, but the world's kind of been in a crazy place for a long, long time, and maybe there can be some truces somewhere that will last and help each other. Thank you.